Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Good day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 184 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc. Oh, where's Mark? Has he not got back from the laundrette yet with those Roberta Tovey embroidered antimacassars? It's typical, isn't it? For months I go on to him about they need to be cleaned. Finally does it, and he does it on the day we're supposed to recording. Hang on, is that him at the door? Is that you, Mark?
Hello! Yes, it's me. Sorry, I got talking to this guy down the laundrette.
Hello.
Oh, hello.
He said he could fix our toilet upstairs that's broken. Don't you remember?
I think we might have been talking across purposes.
Here's the bag of tools.
All right, then. So it's upstairs, is it?
Yeah, just upstairs, just 15th on the right.
15th on the right, okay. I'll go and have a look. What have you boys been eating that's blocked?
It's Hayden. We can blame him, seeing as he's not there.
Well, I think we'd better pay him, hadn't we, Mark? Because I'm always a bit embarrassed, you know, offering someone money. Should we just slip it in his wallet?
Yeah, let's do that, then. He's left his jacket over there. I'll just get his wallet out of his jacket and... Hold on. Look at this. He's got a photo of Hayden in the pocket.
What?
Oh, it's always Hayden, isn't it? It's never us. Oh.
Always the bridesmaids, never the brides. Is that a business card in there as well? Hand it over, Mark. Cutaway Comics.
Oh.
What's that piece of news? Is that some kind of press clipping?
Yeah, that's very odd. I haven't got my reading glasses. Can you read it out?
Yeah. Oh, it's from the latest DWM. We are delighted to announce that screenwriter, journalist and professional watcher of old TV shows Ian Winterton is joining the lineup of presenters on the fourth best Doctor Who podcast, Diddly Dum. Speaking from his Cheshire home, Ian said, "I am beyond excited by this thrilling news. Having been a fan of the legendary Diddly Dum since its very first episode, getting to visit the Whoseum and meet Mark and Doc, the Diddly Dum family, is literally a dream come true, not to mention a career highlight." "That the Diddly Dummers will soon throw the doors of the Whoseum open wide for me is an absolute honour, and I'm pinching myself at the prospect of taking flight with them in the podcast. Where I am quite confident we will soar on to even greater podcasting heights together." Oh,
is that Ian Winterton, the one we invited on to talk about a Doctor Who episode that he really enjoys? Oh no, how embarrassing. I thought he was just some guy. So I hope he fixes the toilet.
Oh, hang on, can you hear some flushing upstairs?
Yeah, I think he's done it.
You guys need to eat more fibre. There's a fatberg in there.
Oh, that'll probably be Bella Emberg. We did invite her to come over tonight. Oh, sorry, did you say a fatberg?
Well, it really is. Now that I look at him, it really is Ian Winterton from Cutaway Comics.
Hello.
Hello. How are you doing, Ian? I forgot we invited him.
That was a baptism of fire. I didn't expect legendary sketches immediately.
So you may remember, faithless listeners, that at Capitol 6 in April, of course you won't remember, will you, because it would have been on someone else's podcast. But those of you, those of you who are gluttons for punishment and listen to both the Diddly Dum podcast and the Cutaway Bunker podcast, will have heard Mark and Hayden and myself being interviewed by a couple of the Cutaway Comics guys. Ian himself, and of course the eminence grease of Cutaway Comics, Gareth Cavana. So Ian, in case we've been misrepresenting you all these years, give us a rundown about Cutaway Comics.
Cutaway Comics, it was an imprint, is the posh word for saying. It's an imprint, it's a publishing company founded by Gareth Cavana.
No, I've never heard of him, sorry.
No, he doesn't do much. He's not. He's a shy, retiring violet.
I was wondering what you were going to say there that started with shh.
Shy, retiring. Did it? A violet, shy, and retiring. Anyway, yeah, he's that Gareth Cavana of Warp Warp. And one of the things he got going was he got chatting with Eric Sayward. I can never say his name. Sayward. Eric Sayward, anyway. Got chatting to him and sort of hit on the idea of Eric writing Litten as a comic. And that became Cutaway Comics. And then COVID-19 happened. And suddenly everything, every other avenue that all of us did was closed, pretty much. So Gareth then said, well, let's start writing comics in earnest. And in like the next 18 months to 2 years, just a huge amount of comics that probably would have come out anyway just kind of came out in one big lockdown-inspired flurry. So far, it's all Doctor Who IP, paid for, not owned by the BBC, but the creators are paid for, or in the case of Eric or Steve Gallagher or Stephen Wyatt or even Bob Baker, his last professional credit was a sequel to his Hand of Fear. Yeah, so sometimes it's us lot writing it, and other times it's the actual creators themselves writing it.
So it's sort of backstory stuff, isn't it? It's content. It's doctorless stories.
Yeah, somebody said in its own little modest way, it's almost like the Disney TV Star Wars universe, which is much more interesting than the Star Wars big movies.
Mm.
Sort of filling in all the little gaps and finding stories amongst the everyday folk. But Gareth has this great line that he always trots out, which is one of the great things about Doctor Who and the amount of imagination Doctor Who requires as a show is because every adventure, you know, every 4 to 6 episodes of the old show or 45 to 90 minutes of the new show is like a pilot episode for an entire universe that gets created and then used, and then the Doctor lands as an adventure and fucks off again. And the whole idea is there's very few Doctor Who stories where you don't go, I wonder what happened next. I wonder what happened on that world next. So that's basically where it all starts from. So, you know, we have Tharals, we have Drax, we have Eldrad. Omega, obviously, yeah, they continued Omega's. Well, I say continued, it's a sort of unofficial prequel. We have to be very careful where we say things are just so we don't get in trouble with the BBC. But you can sort of fill in the gaps and go, well, this Omega isn't quite as mutated and still has a sort of body, so therefore he's probably before the Three Doctors. But you can't sort of say these things overtly.
Ah.
But yeah. But it's been a lot of fun, and I'm getting to work quite closely with Steve Gallagher at the moment because I'm sort of writing stuff to do with Tharals that is part of what we call the Gallagherverse. It's really expanding that rich universe he created 40-odd years ago.
Have you got close enough to Steve yet to actually understand what Warriors Gate's all about?
Sort of, I think. It sort of does mess your head when you're trying to work out how time winds and mirrors and things work. But he seems very happy with what I've written, and I'm sort of following on from his Faustine Princess of Tharal, which is due out any day now from Cutaway. And so the Faustine character is after Steve's adventure is now involved in my big saga, Gods and Monsters, which has, you know, her alongside Drax, pitted against Omega and Eldrad and Sutek and all manner of things in a great big, massive big saga.
Oh, Drax from the Armageddon Factor.
Yeah, and I've absolutely loved writing a couple of Draxes before this one. So Drax by himself. And that's been really good fun because one of the good things about comics is, unlike Big Finish, where they sort of, well, I suppose Big Finish also does have people that do sound-alike performances, but generally they get someone else in if an actor's already passed away. Whereas our Drax looks like Drax from the Armageddon Factor. And I even play with the fact that he goes back to Earth, back to Brixton, after Atreus. And so we've got the baldy version that we know from Armageddon Factor. But then we realise there's a long-haired version when he lands who's still in prison. So that's kind of one of the things. So Drax being rubbish at time travel goes back to before he's been released instead of after. So that's kind of what happens near the beginning. And that's all great fun to be writing all that with Bob Baker before he died. He sort of, you know, signed off on all these storylines and very much wanted to see them go ahead. So that's just, it's been an honour, as they say in press releases.
So how do you know Gareth? Are you a former denizen of the Lasagari?
Yeah, that's where I met him. Because when I first moved back to Manchester, I started doing fringe theatre. And the Lasagari was sort of a little part of that scene. And then as I was going there, I realised, you know, Gareth had named one of the rooms the Salmon Room, and it was full of Adrian Salmon artwork. And the snug was called the Skin Snug, named after Des Skin. And then I got chatting to Gareth and realised he was one of us. Well, one of him, more like. And then, obviously, the Lasagari had lots of sort of mini pub cons and things. And I started basically running the... Because as a journalist and things, I've done my share... And film journalist as well. I've done my share of Q&As.
All right.
So, so I started running Q&As with Donald Tosh and people like that. And then also writing plays, and then that ended up with us doing like weird versions of Stormmine and things like that, some of the Caldor City stuff, but on stage. And it was a mad time when, in the name of getting people to drink at the pub, you just try anything. And every time we put a play on, he sold loads of beer, and that was enough to justify the fact we'd done it. So that was a couple of weird years, which also coincided with the 50th anniversary. That was sort of towards the end.
Mm.
So we had the 50th anniversary madness. People literally, because we had a little mini con, we had people from a few continents come in. I remember there's a woman from Israel, and she'd come over with her Dalek hat on. She'd come over from Israel, and she was going to the big event. Was it Olympia in London? But when she found out on the internet about the Lasagari, she basically booked into her itinerary going to Manchester. She flew into Manchester instead of London so that she could go to our little thing and then go to London. So it was a pretty weird time, the 50th anniversary. And now here we are, preparing for the 60th.
Blimey.
I know.
The Lasagari, of course, being a pub in the centre of Manchester, which Gareth used to run, and which became something of a hub for Doctor Who fandom of a time. So I'm a little puzzled. I didn't quite understand that line you said. So when I went back to Manchester, the whole point of leaving, Ian, is that you'd have to go back.
I know. Well, it wasn't Manchester so much I was leaving, as I went to university in Crewe.
Oh, right.
So, yeah, so I sort of went to London and lived in London and Leeds and various places and New York and Khartoum for a bit. But then I ended up back in Manchester just over 10 years ago, and then I met a woman, and now I live in Cheshire, not far from Crewe. So I shouldn't have bothered leaving.
You met a woman, you see, that's always that danger. You don't want to go doing that.
I know.
I had no idea you're a film journalist.
Yeah, for centuries I was full-time film journalist for... Do you remember Hot Dog magazine?
Oh, yeah, I do, yeah.
Yeah, I used to write for that loads, and a bit for Empire, and a lot of regional stuff.
What's the first cover of Hot Dog? Was that Taxi? Taxi Driver, sorry.
I think it was, yeah, the first one. I seem to remember. Yeah, its original thing, because it was by the people who did Loaded, its original thing was basically, it's got an attitude and it was had as much cleavage in as possible. And they soon realised that was a bit lame. And it just movie magazine with attitude, but without the sexism. So, I thought it was a really good little glossy.
Yes, I used to enjoy it.
But sadly, no more, like so many things. But yeah, I can name drop for England thanks to my decade and a bit of being a full-time film journalist and reviewer and interviewer and film festival goer. It was good, but I'm kind of happier being a writer rather than a journalist.
So have you got anything coming up?
Have I got anything coming up? I'm writing scripts at the moment for TV, but they're all things I can't talk about, and they're all... They're all in development, so it's not like they're about to appear on TV or anything. So I'm in that stage in my career where I get paid to write a lot of things that five people see, with the hope that one day one of those five people will then raise a massive budget.
Five people? Well, now that you've been plugged into the Diddly Dumb listenership, that could easily double.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a living, and that's why the comics are quite good as well, because, you know, they get to be seen and I get a float.
Yeah.
Cutaway flies me to LA to hang out at Gallifrey One and things like that.
Jammy.
Really?
Yeah.
Jammy, jammy.
So the past couple of Februarys, me and Gareth have been in Gallifrey One, selling our wares and signing autographs and generally pretending we're famous, which has been fun. And then hanging out with the great and good of Doctor Who, which has obviously been great. But yeah, and I've got some audio projects coming up and things. But I don't know if they're very Doctor Who friendly. They're kind of more for your Radio 4 type audience.
Oh,
right. Okay. That's one thing that Mark and I do listen to. So what are we talking about? Radio plays, that sort of stuff.
Yeah. No, I do a lot of audio. I mean, we bring Doctor Who into everything, but I did one just before lockdown. We had Julie Hesman-Houch, who's been in Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah.
And I had Robert Glenister, who's obviously been in Doctor Who as well.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of, we're always looking to double bubble stuff. So when that happened, I sort of said to Gareth, well, do you want to offer Robert some money to do a commentary while he's in the studio? So we did. So after the first 2 days, we whacked some Caves of Androzani in the studio and had a few bottles of wine with Robert while he... so that was one of the sort of first cutaway commentaries. That's kind of now one of many. At time of recording, we're about to record Paul Joyce, but I've the Warrior's Gate.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's been another little strand of things I've been doing is turning my Zoom on and recording Justin from the BFI, doing commentaries with various people, which has been quite amusing. Chatting to Matthew Waterhouse and Patricia Quinn was a particularly entertaining one.
Oh, right, yes.
Oh, brilliant.
I had to be her tech support for about 3 hours before the call. And I realised I'd set everything up right. And then she said, now, how do I do this on my computer? Because she'd been doing it on her phone. So then I had to do it all again when she got home. But she was lovely, but just not very tech savvy. And we had Brian Blessed, obviously.
No.
A Zoom with Brian Blessed is a thing. It's just very surreal having these people on screens in your room. But, I mean, I think I've told you this story before, haven't I? But for your listeners, we were sort of recording him doing Mind Warp commentary. But he hadn't really... I think he thought he was just being interviewed. So he didn't really realise why there's an episode of Mind Warp being shared on his screen. So he was just talking. And then, as Justin was trying to sort of say, and anyway, talking about Mind Warp, he suddenly went, "F***ing hell, Kenneth Branagh's in my kitchen." And then Kenneth Branagh walked into shot, into screen, and he'd forgotten, Brian had forgotten that he'd invited Kenneth round. And they live in the same village, or they live nearby. So he had to postpone anyway. And then next time we went on, he realised what the hell he was trying to do. His agent had properly briefed him, and he was absolutely on it and knew the names of everybody.
Oh, wow.
Done his revision and gave an amazing Mind Warp commentary. So good old Brian Blessed, who obviously plays our Omega.
Yes.
Is he coming back or has he finished his stuff now?
Well, the plan is, because I'm writing, the war in Ukraine sort of slowed everything down.
Mm.
Because of the breadbasket of Europe is also where most of the paper comes from as well. So that sort of hit the publishing industry on top of everything else. But yeah, the idea is we'll do an audio version of what I haven't finished writing as a comic yet at some point in the future. And Brian's already set. Brian liked being in our audio play so much that he said we could use his likeness, as you may have seen.
Yes.
Our Omega looks like Brian Blessed, with Brian's permission. And so when we do these comics I'm currently writing as audio plays, the idea is that, yes, it will be Brian Blessed again.
Oh, brilliant. So, Mark, you were just pass me Ian's wallet, will you?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Sorry, Ian. Yeah,
Are there any other ID in here? Oh, here we are. Oh. It's not saying anything. It says Rishi Sunak. Oh. So, anyway, Ian, what were you saying to us about it's all the fault of the war in Ukraine? Anything else in the pipeline?
Oh, yes. The Philip Hinchcliffe book, which hopefully we can announce, and if you're hearing this, listeners, then yes, we've been allowed to announce it, is basically a book of essays, each essay triggered by one of the Hinchcliffe stories. How many did he have? Like, was it 15? 15 Hinchcliffe stories? Something like that. Anyway, my chapter is The Hand of Fear. Is the sort of starting point, and then sort of examining companions, particularly Sarah Jane and Leela, sort of going forward. And our editor is Gary Russell. So I've just had sign-off from Gary today that my chapter is okay, and we've had a few back and forths, and it's signed off, and I don't have to do anything anymore except get paid. But it's going to be very good, and we've got a foreword from Toby Haydoke.
I bet there's never been so many authors writing about the subject of possession.
Possession is a recurring theme during the Hinchcliffe years.
Well, it is 9/10 of the law. Oh, that might be... That could be our title for this podcast.
What's that?
Possession is 9/10 of the law, L-O-R-E.
And it's going to have interviews with Philip in it as well. And when we launch it, it's going to have lots of Philip involvement. Talking of Gallifrey 1, that we're hoping to be taking this to Gallifrey 1 and taking Philip with us.
Oh, marvellous.
And when we go, it's great fun. But when we go and we've provided guests like we did on the first one, when we took Steve and Martin Geraghty with us, then that sort of makes us even more important. I mean, it means we get our hotel room paid for.
Oh.
Which is even nicer. Cutaway doesn't have to spring for it. Yeah, so it's all very exciting. Obviously, Gary's had his big news lately that's just been announced as well, hasn't it, Gary Russell?
Oh, yes. It's novelisation.
He's written the first novelisation of the new Russell T Davies era. What's it called?
Star Beast.
Star Beast, of course it is.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, it's only just been announced. So, yeah, so Mark Morris has written Blue Yonder. What's that laughing?
But
okay.
Who's doing the other novelizations?
Mark Morris is doing Blue Yonder.
Yeah.
And third one.
It's Giggle, was it?
Giggle. I still don't like that as a title.
It's a bit like Let's Kill Hitler, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you see it come up on the screen next week, Let's Kill Hitler.
Oh, it's by James Goss, of course. Yes.
Oh.
By James Goss.
Oh, he's quite good, actually, is as a novelist.
All three of them are cracking writers, obviously. Don't forget, he's also written some of the Doomsday fiction, which I'm sure you've lapped up.
Doomsday. That's not Doom as in this new deadliest assassin in the universe.
Yeah,
is
that's
it?
What I mean, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We'll be mentioning it then. Right, well, welcome to the Who's Here, man.
Hello.
What's been going on? Mark, your story about Algie Ward's brother.
Yes. Oh.
Do you want to retell it?
Do you want to? Isn't it a bit boring for the listeners?
Boring for the listeners?
I know, when's that ever stopped us in the past?
We got some nice feedback from clearly the rockers among Doctor Who aficionados to our paying a tribute to the late Algie Ward by titling our last episode the Algie Ward Memorial Podcast. Not that there was more than about 2 minutes content on Algie, really, because it's about... Mark was slightly miffed that Algie's passing had seemed to receive relatively little coverage in the media.
Yes, I forgot to mention that time that I was playing a gig in Tunbridge Wells in the mid-90s. With Midwich, the heavy metal band with whom I played bass. And this guy came up to me at half time and he complimented me on my bass playing, insisted on buying me a pint. And I was having a chat with him during the half time interval. And it turns out that he was Algie Ward's brother, who also roadied for Lemmy and amongst other rock legends. So, yeah, so that was very much a high point in my musical life, being complimented by Algie Ward's brother on my bass playing. I was particularly pleased that one of Lemmy's roadies would compliment us, because we'd just been doing our cover version of Ace of Spades, which always tore the hell out of my fingers whenever we played it. Because unlike Lemmy, I don't play with a plectrum, so it absolutely rips my fingertips to pieces. So, here we are. It's a quick anecdote.
So when Mark told us this after we'd recorded the last episode, I think, oh, that's why he's feeling quite sentimental about the passing of Algy. And I must say, when Mark was telling us this, I knew he'd said all along that Algy had been a bassist. And a picture is popping up in my mind of Mark standing on a stage, craving a double bass against the length of his body.
Oh, you're so cultured, Doc.
And sort of very classically plucking at the strings with his fingers. And I thought, there's something wrong here. I mean, we've all seen the photo of Mark in his band days with Midwich. And I thought, yeah, I've seen people play the double bass in classical concerts, but they're always in white tie and tails. Why am I seeing Mark in leathers? And then I realised, oh, bass guitar! And that's when I realised I really don't pretend to understand other people's enthusiasms. You'll probably be aware, listeners, that once one of our podcasts has gone through all its editing stages, we put it online and then plug it with links all over social media. And to try to make it stand out, we invariably add a piece of design. Now, in days of yore, the Rev used to actually draw and paint these in watercolours. Some of you may remember some of his gorgeous paintings. If not, our show notes can be found as ever at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. But now that it's up to us, we slap something together on paint.net, usually a few photos relating to that week's topics. And Mark had spoken about the passing of Algy Ward. And because it clearly meant something to Mark, I googled Algy Ward, found a photo of him, added it to this design of the Pandorica last week, and without telling Mark, put the podcast online with the title The Algy Ward Memorial Podcast. And while I was fiddling with Twitter, a tweeted reply from Mark came up along the lines of, "Aw, thanks, Doc." And then a minute later, it disappeared again. So I messaged Mark saying, have you deleted your reply? And he said, "Well, yeah, I really appreciated the tribute, but before replying, I thought I'd better wait until I found out who the guy in the photo was." And I drew myself up to my full 5'10", and was about to say with great scorn, "Don't you even know who your hero looks like, Mark?" Then I thought, hang on. Because when Mark gets onto one of his passions, he really knows his stuff. So I re-googled Algy Ward. I went into the original obituary that I'd found and realised that the photo I'd taken a copy of was one of the many photos surrounding the article, providing links to other bits of music news.
Yeah. I think you put a photo of Jez Coleman from Killing Joke on.
So I redid it. There we are. Talking of the last episode, if I had a letter in from a friend of the show, Johnny Dabb. Hello, Diddly Dummers. Funnily enough, I have a Season 5 rewatch coming up soonish. As for the Big Bang the Pandorica Opens, which we reviewed last time, in the past I scored it as a 4 out of 10.
What?
As I find the acting is a very high standard and the sets and music are brilliant, but it would be very much more enjoyable to watch if only I knew what was going on. Is the gist Amy's crap? You really need to be careful on punctuating something if you're going to say something like this. Is the gist Amy's crack is the TARDIS exploding? River tempts the Doctor to the Pandorica to investigate it, and all his old enemies turn up to lock him in and save the universe from the Doctor ending it. But they got it wrong, and it was the TARDIS exploding which then ended the universe, as the Doctor wasn't there to save it, apart from the Earth which had the TARDIS as its sun. Amelia then opens the Pandorica to wake up and save the Doctor. Amy, Rory and the Doctor make a Big Bang 2 using an exploding TARDIS, and Amy's memory of the old universe is a template for the new universe, as only Amy can remember the old universe because she has a crack. Please could you correct me if I have made a mistake with that, or if I've missed something important. I do find this story very confusing and convoluted. P.S. Cool interview with Wendy Padbury. She's a lovely lady. Thanks, Johnny Depp. Johnny Depp. Thanks, Johnny Dabb. I think that's roughly... you've roughly got the gist of it there, Johnny.
It was interesting hearing your last episode, because it did make me go, maybe it's time, because a lot of that era I haven't rewatched, because I just sort of watched it, it went in, I didn't mind it. And I remember not... The fact that you can't sit down and say, this is what happened during that era, really bothers me. As someone who writes timey-wimey stuff and, you know, writes for a living, the fact that I always get turned off by people that and making it up as they go along. And there's nothing wrong with that, as long as you can't tell. But, you know, as soon as you can tell someone's making up as they go along and they have storylines flapping away, I don't like it. And there was too much of that for my money going on in that era. It all seemed very clever. And then the fact that it's not all tied up, it just goes, what? What's going on? Exactly what with the silence? Was it the TARDIS blowing up that rebooted the universe or what? Who blew the TARDIS up? Was it the silence?
Yes, it was the silence, I think.
I think that was the question we were left with at the end, wasn't it? But I don't recall it being made very clear in the next series.
No, and it's sort of, I think it's sort of rushed through, but it's just the fact that, for me, I'm a structure nerd and I do like my plots. And if your plots are good, then everything else, and I think that's why I'm much more into RTD's era of the new stuff, because it's got everything in the right place, whereas Moffat's got a lot of enthusiasm and some amazing things, but they don't quite tie up together. I mean, even Heaven Sent, that everyone goes on about loving, has him going, I'm the hybrid at the end, which makes me go, are you? I don't remember that bit.
No.
And again, we've got a thing of, how does that all tie up together? Because it was a great cliffhanger at the time, and then it wasn't. So now that's forever tainted.
No, I tend to agree. I didn't really like the hybrid stuff.
That's interesting, because the fan mantra, isn't it, that RTD was all about character, not so much about plot. Moffat was all about plot, not so much about character. So I thought it was interesting you said that.
Yeah, I mean, this will probably feed into the episode we're discussing is Russell T Davies is very much about plot. He knows story down to his bones. He knows story. He knows structure. He doesn't arse about with it. I mean, I teach at university and I teach structure, and I always use a Russell T Davies quote at the beginning from The Writer's Tale, which is him going on about how much he hates books that teach you structure in screenwriting. But he has this great quote, which is, somebody bought me, you know, the Robert McKee storybook, and I opened it and flinched at what I read and shut it, but not because he didn't like it, but because it was so accurate to how his brain works. And he didn't really want to be that analytical about it. But actually, that's why it's a really good way of introducing people to structure, because he knows full well that's what he does. And the rest of us that aren't quite as amazing as he is have to think about it sometimes. Have to go, oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, how do I improve this? Oh, I move that bit about. I do this.
I'm going to say it. Who's Robert McKee?
He's a scriptwriting guru from the 70s and 80s.
Oh, right.
And he's so famous that Brian Cox, the actor, not the physicist, played him in a movie with Nicolas Cage, in which Nicolas Cage also plays the screenwriter and his fictional brother, and it's called Adaptation. I got there in the end. Adaptation with Nicolas Cage. So in that, Brian Cox, the character who is actually the screenwriter, and the screenwriter is the guy who wrote
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind?
Yeah, yeah.
And Being John Malkovich.
Yeah, yeah. They're kind of tonally quite similar. But they're kind of similar kind of time, early century, and weird sort of indie feel. But yeah, but Charlie Kaufman in this movie, written by Charlie Kaufman, the main character is Charlie Kaufman, played by Nicolas Cage. But also Charlie Kaufman's brother, who doesn't exist, who's his twin brother, who's also a screenwriter, also played by Nicolas Cage. And so it's a really good film, actually, but it really, really deals with structure, and it's probably a bit self-indulgent, and it just goes really mad at the end because they try and have their cake and eat it. And you're sort of in the movie that they've written, and also in, but it's kind of hard. But anyway, during one bit of it, they go to one of these great big screenwriting events that really happen, and Brian Cox is playing Robert McKee. So that's the level of fame that Robert McKee has in Hollywood. Anyway, how do we get onto that?
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Yeah, I really like it because of the sort of nature of it. I always thought it was a bit like, you know, like when they adapt a Philip K. Dick novel.
Yeah.
They get rid of his ridiculously long titles, which are wonderful, but they get rid of them and call them Minority Report or Blade Runner or whatever.
Yeah, Total Recall, which I watched last night.
Yeah, it's like Growing the Other Way. It's like, let's have a silly long title, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And you could imagine it being based on a Philip K. Dick book of the same name almost. Because it's about a machine that makes you forget your relationships and whatever memories you... It's kind of, we will forget it for you wholesale. Which was became, you know, what was it? We'll remember it for you wholesale.
Which was Total Recall.
Total Recall, yeah.
Yeah.
So RTD on structure. Are we talking about the structure of writing or the structure of plotting?
Well, plotting, yeah. Plotting is structure. I mean, it is. It's all many things. But his plots are all tight and work really well and don't have loads of little flappy threads where you don't quite know what happened at the end of it. And you don't have bits, certainly not bits that are noticeable, where you go, hang on a minute, how did that happen? How did they get there? Which for me is another big turn-off of thing. And they call that the, I think it was Hitchcock who said it, they call that the sort of refrigerator test. You can watch a movie or a piece of TV and it washes over you and you're entertained and you go, oh, that was good. And then in the middle of the night when you're getting up to get a glass of milk and you open the refrigerator, you go, hang on a minute. And that for me means a piece of drama hasn't quite worked because, you know, that means when you rewatch it, you go, oh, God. And for me, that's what a lot of Who doesn't work because it's got bits that we then know later don't make sense.
Yeah,
it's, that really bothers me.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, but I mean, I used to rewatch Series 5 and bits of Series 6 and, funnily enough, Series 2, which we'll come back to, quite a lot. But I've always thought Series 5, always think it hangs together quite well. Yeah, it does end with a mystery and we don't know at that point who's blown the TARDIS up or quite what's going on. But I feel that Series 5 is fairly well perfectly structured. I mean, like I say, it leaves open the question for the next season, which maybe isn't dealt with properly. But I just think as a whole, Series 5, and I don't know, I find it very satisfying, as I said on the podcast.
It's one of those ones where I might want to go back and have a rewatch because I do actually genuinely like, you know, I remember liking all those, you know, I love Matt Smith and Amy and Rory not so much. But generally, I really did like it. I really liked, in a similar way, I really liked Impossible Astronaut and everything. I like the beginnings of his things.
Yes, yeah.
And then they, I don't know, they always talk about sticking the landing. It's almost like he spins his plates and they'll fall on the floor. And then, and anyway, next season, I'll get it right. next Doctor, I'll get it right.
Yeah, I do think that with Stephen Moffat, I think Series 5 and then probably his last season were the most satisfying ones that held together best.
I absolutely loved his last season of Capaldi. I thought some of the best.
And Bill,
that some of the best the show has been since it's come back.
Yes.
And that was the most I'd enjoyed it since Russell T. Davis.
Well, he does stick the landing as well, doesn't he? As long as you pretend that Twice Upon a Time doesn't exist.
I know. Bit of a shame, that. But when you, I mean, as I think we said when we were talking, when we saw Stephen Moffat at Capital, I started having palpitations when he was just recounting his workload.
Yeah.
Those years. As a writer who lives with deadlines, Stephen Volk, who is my best known for doing Ghostwatch, I interviewed him a year or so ago on a podcast, and he said being a writer is like always having homework, and that's such an accurate... Always having homework to do for the rest of your life. And that is a very good description of it. You always have that feeling you most people lose in their childhood hanging over you. And so to hear Moffat saying in 12 months, he wrote, 16 hours of television on top of actually being an exec producer, well, not even an exec producer, being the producer and the showrunner and sort of doing that on Sherlock as well. It's just too much. It's mental. And doing insane. You know, someone should have said, no, you can't do both of these at once. It's not just going to be bad for his health. It's going to be bad for the show. And I think ultimately it's a miracle it came out as well as it did.
Yeah.
You know, like very, very good. But for me, I personally would have liked a bit more.
Is it possible that Russell's, I mean, this is me talking as a fan in the street, he says, with incredible false modesty that no one's falling for. I don't read textbooks by Robert McKee, but so I don't think about it that deeply. But is it possible that Russell's plotting is actually folded better into his stories? Because you don't tend to... It's not all... It tends to be the Stephen Moffat stories where that sort of thing is front and centre.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what the point is, that of course, if Russell wrote a story where the plot didn't work, we'd all been saying, oh, what a dreadful writer. But it's mainly because the plots are less front and centre with Russell than characterisation. Whereas with Stephen, they are, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think what it is, it's the writer is responsible for, you know, obviously, this goes about, it seems stupid to say this, but the writer is responsible for everything in the story, and that includes what he set out to do. And if you make an overcomplicated plot that you lose track of, that's your fault as a writer. No one said you've got to do this story that's too difficult for you yourself to do.
Yeah.
Then it reminds me of, like, when my brother and his mates, I'm not a musician at all, but they're all really into, like, writing songs when we were young. You know, he was in bands, and their songs were always, they never really worked, because they were always quite complicated and really ambitious. And I always said, just listen to the songs you like. They're like three chords and a chorus, the Beatles and things. And it's like, that's being simple, you know, being complicated isn't good. That's why jazz sounds so shit most of the time. And to get something simple and amazingly well done is still really, really complicated. And I sometimes think that throwing the kitchen sink at a plot and starting off every episode with a million different locations that always all going to tie together. Just have the Doctor land somewhere, have an adventure, see if you can do that. Because they're all the ones we keep watching over and over again.
I find it a bit frustrating sometimes. I quite often see online a lot, people who are particularly keen on Chris Chibnall's era say, there was a poll recently, this guy, Herald of Creation, on Twitter, who does these big long story polls where he does put one story up against another story. And
oh, yes, yeah.
And the other day it was The Power of the Doctor, which was Jodie's last episode, versus Evil of the Daleks, you know, the Patrick Troughton classic. And Evil of the Daleks was, I think it was about something like 58% to 42%. And this person who really liked Power of the Doctor came on and said, oh, this is so unfair. How can Power of the Doctor be losing to Evil of the Daleks? And I was, you know, Evil of the Daleks is a classic. It's a great story. And it's a brilliant Doctor. And somebody said that to them. They said, no, this person said, no. If Power of the Doctor has brought back classic companions, it's brought back classic Doctors, and it's got an amazing regeneration scene. If Russell T. Davies or Stephen Moffat had written this story, everyone would be saying it was an all-time classic. I just thought, well, that's just so untrue, because
that's possibly because if they had, it probably would have been an all-time classic.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, isn't it? It's more than, oh, this is all the fireworks you throw in. Yeah. Like, oh, companions, Doctors. You know, it's more than that. And I also thought, well, you know, Russell T. Davies and Stephen Moffat have their name attached to many a Doctor Who episode that is not regarded as an all-time classic. You know, they have their names attached to some really duff episodes as well.
The episode we're talking about today is not universally loved.
No, it's not. for some reason. But I think this is actually quite a good story to talk about.
Yeah.
Sort of moving on to it, which is Love and Monsters from Series 2. I think it's actually quite a good story to talk about in relation to what you've been talking about, Ian, with regards to plotting.
Oh, that's what the laundry and the jacket reference was about. Oh!
Yes. But also what you're talking about with regards to the toxicity of Doctor Who fans.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Yes.
Obviously comes into play.
Yeah, well, and Love and Monsters has had its fair bit of, like you say.
Well, guys, we're all in Doctor Who podcasting. No one needs to lecture us on the toxicity of fandom.
No. But I think this was the first time when I realised, because I went, oh, that was a good, fun episode. And that was the first time I got a barrage of like people going, what are you talking about? On the forums and stuff.
Is this on first broadcast?
Yeah, yeah. And they were like really angry about this episode.
I really enjoyed this.
I think back then I've never been one for doing massive amounts of forums and stuff until Twitter came and took over our lives. But I think I was on the Guardian comments page to talk about Doctor Who, which was quite depressing.
Oh, when you could comment under the TV reviews and
yeah,
things.
Yeah. And that was always, you know, whenever I was at work and fancied not doing any work. I'd go and see the absolutely insane people shouting at each other about how much they hated this episode, how much they loved this episode. It was the first time I really remember going, oh my God, I think Russell T. Davis had done quite well up till that point. It pleased quite a lot of people. That's just certainly how it seemed to me. Everyone I knew was quite happy. And then Love and Monsters was the first time people went, what the hell was that? And then it was Fear Her next week. And it was Doctor Who will be cancelled.
Yes. Yeah, I suppose this is a bit like... Is this like the Romans of the Russell T. Davis era?
Gosh.
It's the first episode that really tries to do almost all-out comedy. I mean, obviously, it's got loads of poignant moments in it. But it really goes... I mean, it doesn't hide that it's dropping in lines, it's dropping in gags. You know, the fact that you've got Peter Kay and his performance, both as Victor Kennedy and the Absorbilov.
Also, the director, this is his only Doctor Who episode, because everything else on...
Dancer.
Yeah, everything else on his filmography is comedy.
Right.
Inside Number 9 and all manner of...
Oh, right.
But he's a comedy director, and I'd never heard of him before. But yeah, Gangster Granny strikes again. Sky Comedy Shorts, The Queen and I, Eric Ernie and Me. He did the Inside 9 Pram Face. He did that brilliant Hattie Jakes biopic on BBC Four. But yeah, an Ideal, loads and loads of Ideal, and Fat Friends and things like that. But yeah, so they basically went, let's get a comedy director in for this one. And because it's a funny episode.
It is. It's a very funny episode. Again, in the same way that I really enjoyed the Romans and the Mythmakers, I don't see why Doctor Who can't just occasionally let its hair down and just do a really good comedy.
No, and I think it's the fact that this is the same show as Genesis of the Daleks. Does that not just say how Doctor Who can be anything it wants to be?
Yes.
I wouldn't like Doctor Who if it was like Love and Monsters every week.
No.
I think it'd be too throwaway then. The stakes wouldn't feel... real. But for 45 minutes, it's brilliantly written and funny. But also, like you say, I think the most important thing, and this is what Russell T. Davis brings, is he just gets you in the feels so effectively. And he constantly does that with everything he's ever done. He can play your emotions like a piano. He just knows what to do to the human brain to have a line that does that, a bit of a pause, and a line that does that, that makes you go, oh, I think I'm going to cry now. But he is a genius. And, you know, this really silly thing still makes me, oh, she's going to have to live the rest of her life as a paving slab, but I'm still moved that she didn't die. It's amazing.
I'd never thought that there would be comedy directors. I mean, in the sense that they have so well, here's a comedy, we must get so-and-so because he's a comedy director. I mean, obviously, you probably wouldn't get... oh, come on, give me a name of a really, really highfalutin director, probably director, Stephen Polyakov play.
Well, Stephen Polyakov.
Oh, is the actual director as well as... Okay, you're not going to say I'm going to be doing...
Saul Dibb, who I've just been watching his really grim thing with Timothy Spall and Anne Reed, which is amazing.
Oh, The Sixth Commandment.
Yeah, yeah. Brilliant, but really hard watch.
That was... Peter Farker, taught me English at school.
Oh, my God, really? So you were at... Was it Stowe, is it?
Yeah. I'm from Manchester, Ian, not Winchester. Earlier in his career. No, he was... And looks extraordinarily like him. You know, Timothy Spall. And, of course, no one other than people like me are going to know what he actually looks like.
Yeah, yeah, they showed the picture at the end of episode 4, because I just watched it for lunch. And then you go, oh, Timothy Spall really does look like him.
So I know that Russell T. Davis is going to say, this Love and Monsters, this is going to be a funny one. I'll get Stephen Polyakov to do it. But I didn't realise that they'd specifically go for, oh, that's a director who's skilled at comedy, because I'm in the middle of reading a book about how they made Yes Minister. And for the pilot episode, for some reason, the BBC, as a director, cast this guy, Stuart Allen, whose back catalogue for directing was stuff like On the Buses and George and Mildred. And the writers, Jay and Lynn, turned up at the Acton Hilton while they were rehearsing and found that Stuart Allen's director had been inserting lines into the very carefully written ironic script to try and make it a bit more funny. Like he had Hacker's wife crawling around on the floor of their flat and saying, "Can you wiggle your bottom a bit more?" And so they eventually gave it over to Sidney Lottaby, and then Stuart Allen went off to direct, this is very telling, Mind Your Language.
Oh, God.
I know what it is. It was on ITV, though, so we didn't really watch ITV.
Oh, right.
So my dad worked for the Beeb. And we really had this weird thing that we didn't really watch. There were adverts on ITV, so it was best not to watch it because it was consumerist nonsense. And so I've still got this weird... There's lots of things I missed. I didn't see Children of the Stones, and I've never seen The Tomorrow People. There's quite a lot of things I didn't get to see because ITV was unofficially verboten. But yeah, even now I don't like adverts. I find, you know, I say to my kids now exactly what my dad said, which is as a joke, but adverts are evil. But I still say it in the same jokey way to my kids, adverts are evil. And so then they say it when they're skipping adverts on YouTube, adverts are evil.
Yes.
Because, yeah, that's one of the best things about streaming is we get to finally not be sold shit all the time.
Well, whenever I'm visiting my mum back up in Manchester, I mean, it says, oh, something's on. So what time does it start? All right, we'll set it to live record and we'll start watching it at 9:30 so that as soon as the adverts come on, you can quickly speed through them. So what were we saying about...
But Love and Monsters... Well, one of the things, you sent me that brilliant Red Button audio.
Oh, it was good, that, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've never listened. I didn't even know such things existed. I didn't have a Red Button.
They broadcast it on the Saturday evening, and on the Sunday evening the next day, they broadcast it on BBC Four. And if you pressed the Red Button, you could... They didn't do it for the Series 1. They started with Series 2. I don't think it lasted very long. But it was really interesting.
But yeah, no, Susie Liggett, as they sort of say in that commentary, oh, I'm assistant director. But yeah, she's just been promoted to producer. Next season, she produced Human Nature and Family of Blood, like two of the best episodes of Doctor Who ever, for my money.
We're talking about the complexity of Stephen Moffat's career. When she was describing, when they said, oh, tell us what sort of work you do, Susie, she was talking about, I have to arrange that, you know, the cameras will be here for X number of hours, and therefore, the actors will be here, and this actor will be doing something else that morning, so we'll have to choose us to film a scene. I would find that horrendously complicated.
Oh, God, it's, I mean, being a first AD, I've been on my share of sets for various films and stuff, and the first AD is the person who, you know, is quite stressed, but they need to not necessarily look stressed. You know, like she said, I have to shout, then she sort of tried to backpedal on that. And go, or persuade people to work quickly. And I was like, no, shout. You got it right first time. You shout. You go, okay, people, next set up, kind of thing. And, you know, so it's an incredibly complicated job. And you're just there with spreadsheets and going, oh, my God, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And that's going to be there. And we've lost an actor for a morning. And then we've got to, can we film some other scenes? And all these, TV, all TV is, if you don't like it, then you cannot do it.
Yeah,
because it's awful. It's a bit like that brilliant Moffat quote about The Writer's Tale. Have you read The Writer's Tale?
Yes.
Yeah.
I loved it. I have it by my desk, and every so often I'll just dip into it because I just love the catnip of Russell T. Davis firing off emails, being stressed and having a million plates to spin. And there's a brilliant quote by Stephen Moffat, I think when he was reviewing it, saying, if you want to be a writer and you read The Writer's Tale, and you still want to be a writer, you are a writer. Because it's a bit like, if you can't take the stress of working in TV, no one would do it if they didn't like it, because it's awful. And so if you don't get a buzz out of that awfulness and that stress, then don't do it. I mean, every time you get someone who's young on a set or something, whatever job they're in, whether they're writing or they're one of my students or anything, and you get them and you see them going, oh, this is a bit hard, isn't it? I don't like this. You go... You just want to go to them and go, stop now, change your degree, because you're not cut out for this then. If you think this is bad and you're not enjoying yourself, this isn't the career for you. Don't do it. Do something else, because it's awful. Can you imagine doing the most stressful job in the world and you don't even like it? What's the point?
I've been doing it for 35 years, Ian.
Yeah, I don't know. Ask Rishi Sunak.
Yeah, exactly. Ian, you were going to say about the Red Button episode that I sent.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the things from that, it's it reminded me of the phrase double banking. Mm. So this is a double banker in that they're filming something else with the main cast while they're doing this. And this is what they had to do when they were given an extra episode, but the same money, or the same time anyway, maybe more money, but the same time. So they had to come up with double banking episodes. And obviously next season it was Blink, which is slightly better received than Love and Monsters, I would say.
Just a little bit.
As soon as I heard that, I mean, this is a contender for title. I've had a Uptown top ranking, but Uptown double banking.
Nice.
By, oh God, what are they called?
No Pope, No Style.
Yeah, No Pope, No Style. What are they called? The
Aletha and Donna.
Yeah, Aletha and Donna. I've had that literally since yesterday as my ear. Oh. But no, I thought it's really interesting seeing people when they've just recorded it as well. So they're not like, oh God, this is Love and Monsters and lots of people hate this, or
yeah,
this is just, here's the latest episode, isn't it brilliant, and here's all the cool things.
And they're not doing like a behind the sofa where they're looking back on
no
something that where they can barely remember. They actually remember.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably almost like yesterday.
But it was just from a point of view of just from the logistics, when they said they've got 35 story days. And that means...
Oh, what did they mean by that?
Well, they mean, you have story days in a script when you break the script down. So each of those days is a different day, so they have to be wearing something different. And you don't usually have anywhere near as many as 35.
Oh!
One of the things they work out is, what day is this? When's this happening? And in this one, they had 35 of them in one 45-minute episode.
Wow. I was thinking, it surely didn't take 35 days to film this, did it?
No.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, no, it had 35 days in a 45-minute script,
mm-hmm.
Which is unheard of. Like, if you think about your average Doctor Who episode, for instance, how many different costumes are they wearing? One. Because they're...
For the whole season.
Well, yeah, yeah. But they tend to wear, you know, all the characters that are in it tend to be...
Yeah.
Pretty much it happens on the same day.
Yes.
Quite often. So, but the fact that this one was 35 different days...
Maybe Susie Leggett said, the only way we can get through this is if we find some excuse for having a laundrette in it.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll be able to clean all the clothes otherwise. Although, of course, in reality, in 35 days, people wouldn't wear 35 different costumes. Would your family be wearing what I wore last Tuesday, next Wednesday?
When I'm writing, I tend to wear the same crap polo shirt every day. Until I have to go out somewhere, in which case I have a shower and change my clothes.
Well, when I'm editing the podcast, I do it naked.
Well, powerful image.
It's highly erotic.
Mark, talk to us.
Did you saying that make you think of your mother and then think, oh God, I've got to let Mark speak?
I feel awful when she lectures me. Which one's Mark again? The nice one, Mum. Oh, you're fat. She doesn't understand a word of what we're talking about, of course, but she just said, I just like this, you're listening to you talking to your friends. And I said, friends? You misunderstanding a relationship.
What would your mother think of the phrase rudimentary police system? Which they're right is a very, very good line that apparently, was it Jane Tranter, they said, begged for it to stay in the script.
I have to say, when I was watching that today, and I was thinking, I was trying to picture what sort of rudimentary police system he might have been able to have... concocted in such a short time to get to the window. I do think this is a great demonstration of really good writing, because I think to come up with the framing device of Elton's video blog is really smart. And obviously, because as you say, it's a double banked episode, Ian, it doesn't feature David Tennant very much. So it's just a really nice device to get to see the world through Elton Pope's eyes. And gives him an excuse to actually do monologues to the camera as well.
Mm.
And I also love the fact that it gives them the opportunity to completely mess around with the continuity of it. Not in a timey-wimey way particularly, but just moving bits of the narrative around so it's told in a different order.
It's so... Just having the little flashes of, like, when Ursula's first introduced and you have that flash of her screaming.
Yeah, that's... That's exactly what I was going to mention, actually, was that montage. And so they got little shots of her and Elton all doing nice stuff. And then it's just that 1 second, literally almost 1 second, isn't it, of in that beautiful montage of Ursula screaming, and Elton says, poor Ursula. And it's really clever the way it does that. I quite often like the changes of gear in this as well. There's so much of it is like purely done as like a kind of sitcom almost, and it works really well like that. But then there's, Camille Kadiri is fantastic in this. Absolutely brilliant. Her seduction of Elton is very funny. That whole thing where Elton's going, right, I've got to do this to be clever, and he ends up having to do nothing. He has to make no effort whatsoever to infiltrate the Tyler household. And I just think that's very clever and very funny. And then all the way up to that very last seduction scene where she goes, oops, and she throws her wine all over him and says, look, it's ruined that husky voice of hers. God, I love Camille Kadiri's voice so much. But then there's, just like I said, there's that gear change, isn't there? When she's come off the phone to Rose and it's suddenly gone from this rom-com into something much more poignant. And she gets some great lines as well, doesn't she? When she confronts him in the street and she says it.
I was looking for the doctor.
Oh, I know that. I worked that out. Because it's never me, is it?
No, but that's how it started, but I changed my mind.
Let me tell you something about those who get left behind. Because it's hard. And that's what you become, hard. But if there's one thing I've learned, it's that I will never let her down. And I'll protect them both until the end of my life.
I just think it's really powerful, especially the juxtaposition of that with all the sort of heartwarming comedy that's gone on before.
Yeah, well, there's a reason actors love Russell T Davies, because he gives even quite small characters and even quite small scenes, they move around so much emotionally. There's always so much to do. Every scene will have its own little rhythm and will end on a brilliant line or a brilliant emotion. And just that little sequence itself is like a mini short story. It's like, you know, the seduction of Jackie Tyler, and it has its own little thing. It's all fun and games. And then she gets a phone call, and then she gets really sad, and then she gets really angry, you know, and it has its own, it never stops moving a good script. And Russell T Davies' scripts are always good. They're just always good.
Yeah.
And there are various degrees of good, but they're always good. That's just why his era, for me. Where did I hear it? Was it you on your podcast, or was it another podcast? I listen to so many.
What?
Somebody, I know, Podultery. Somebody on one of the podcasts said Russell T Davies as Doctor Who was amazing TV and Stephen Moffat's was amazing Doctor Who, which is a sort of thesis point to discuss.
Yeah.
Was Moffat amazing Doctor Who? I'd say it's got to be both anyway. It's got to be amazing TV that is Doctor Who, because otherwise it's not Doctor Who. And Russell T Davies was always Doctor Who and amazing TV. And this is an example of everything the show can do in lots of ways. I mean, it doesn't go really dark, but it still gets pretty dark. It has a dead mum. It does so many things in 45 minutes. It has us getting to the core of Elton's loss at the centre that he has filled with Doctor Who, which is so much the story of a lot of Doctor Who fans. Is, you know, last time we were together in Capital, we sort of talked about how a lot of it was the sort of absent fathers and, yeah, you know, all that sort of stuff. Or if people haven't got absent fathers, then you're still the lonely weird kid and you latch onto Doctor Who. And so it has all this in this 45 minute episode that Elton, without spelling it out, Elton has missed his mum, and the reason he's been obsessed with the Doctor is because the Doctor was there the night his mum died. And that's just a brilliant piece of storytelling. Just, I mean, everything about this, I'd say everything about this works, apart from the absorbable off in the room, which is that monster bit, which I think is why people, I think there's a certain class of fan that can't stand a bad monster. And I don't know why they're Doctor Who fans, if that's the case.
Yes.
Because you can't stop liking Doctor Who.
It's possibly the same people who can't enjoy Invasion of the Dinosaurs, which is just an absolutely brilliant story. But some people can't look past the dodgy dinosaur effects.
Well, I must say, so I'm doing all the talking, but because
that's all right for you, you're a guest.
I had literally one of the most wonderful times with my middle son. He's 14. Well, he's just been 14. He was 13 a few weeks ago, and he doesn't mind Doctor Who, but he's not mad on it. And he used to like it to please me when he was little. And he still gets on about it, and he really liked Power of the Doctor. He sort of came back on board after years because of all the Easter eggs and classic stuff. He just loved the fact that they were bringing stuff back. But he sat down with ITVX, and I went, I bet you won't believe what the dinosaurs look like in Invasion of the Dinosaurs. And we put it on. And when we got to the dinosaur bits, it was just so joyous. We fell off the chair. He just couldn't believe what he was seeing. I thought he was going to have an asthma attack. He was just... He's not asthmatic. He literally was hyperventilating with laughter. And we were both on our knees, just slapping the floor, just laughing so much. And it was just absolutely joyous. Just like literally one of the most wonderful afternoons ever. But also the story is amazing. It's like really exciting.
And he was,
oh my God, it's not a real spaceship. Oh my God, it's spoiler alert for people that haven't seen Invasion of the Dinosaurs yet. But yeah, that was a story that I just loved as a target book and had never really watched on TV until fairly recently. And I'd always heard the dinosaurs were quite funny, and they, my God, they were. Just like when the T-Rex is attacking the sauropod, the Brontosaurus,
yeah,
and his teeth around its neck, but the teeth are made of rubber too, so they're bending. It's just amazing.
Oh.
Just amazing. Just so funny. But just so amazing.
The other thing to let, if you want to let the Absorbloth off a bit, is the fact that it was designed by a child.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I'm guessing the production team had to kind of work the Absorbloth into a story somehow.
Yeah, I think that's why they probably made it the funny one.
Yeah.
Because they went, you know what? We're going to have an Absorbloth. Let's just full out, you know, we'll have a stand-up comic as the monster, and we'll really lean into it, into the grossness, and then make it funny. But then, because it's Russell T. Davis, he can't help himself but make it incredibly moving.
Yeah.
It's just weird, isn't it? Think of that Absorbloth running down the street, and it's shit, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it's awful.
It's shit, and it looks silly, and I do remember my arse cheeks clenching a little bit at it. But then I was going, but it's funny, and it's not going to be a huge story arc about the Absorbloth. We're not going to go to Clom in every episode. We'll never see this monster again. It's fine. But even then, after that, they still, A, made me laugh with one of my favourite lines ever, which is,
Elton, fetch a spade!
Yes.
Which I absolutely love. And then Ursula's not dead. And it literally made me tingly on the face. Oh. After this stupid, stupid monster that he managed to have in it, but actually disguised as a human cunningly for nearly the whole episode, which is also a way of going, we've used you, monster. We have, for 5 minutes.
Also, with that bit, you've got that whole bit with the Absorbloth, and it's all kind of funny and gross and stuff.
Mm.
And then there's that really touching moment when Rose goes to Elton to comfort him at the end as well, and even that's really touching.
Yeah, I mean, it's just it's a really, I don't know, I mean, it does regularly get, you mention it in a room full of Doctor Who fans, and it generally gets laughs of derision.
Mm.
I think it's a 50-50 split, I would say, but I would say that divide between those halves, there's quite a big gap there, isn't there? People who like it tend to really like it, as I do. And the people who dislike it tend to very loudly and actively hate it.
I know. But I know somebody who really hates it, and his favourite episode ever is The Happiness Patrol. And I've had to sort of go on a bit of a journey with The Happiness Patrol, because I still find it hard to watch. But I maybe accept that the Candyman isn't as shit as I thought he was when I was a teenager. But he's still pretty awful. And there is a massive irony if you don't like Love and Monsters because of the Absorbloth, but your favourite episode has the Candyman in it.
Yes.
I'd say you're not being consistent. Like, people really, really hate Warriors of the Deep because of the Murker and because of the lighting, but I've always found it quite a good episode.
It's much better. It's one of those stories that's much better, I think, than its reputation.
Yeah. Obviously, it could have been better if they'd done things differently. But as a sort of solid, this is quite exciting. It's about, you know, two blocks on the brink of nuclear war, and there are Sea Devils and Silurians, and it's pretty thrilling.
Mm.
You know, and it's on a quite good-looking sea base.
Yeah, there should have been another way.
And then the Merker comes in, dobbing off Rent-A-Ghost, but, you know.
I think this is probably only the third time I've watched this last night.
Yeah.
And I can't really think why. The first time, probably, I did think it was a bit meh. Yeah, but I can't remember how much I was swayed by what others were saying.
Mm.
Because, maybe only because towards the end of his first season, I wasn't yet fully cognizant of how much David Tennant was annoying me. Because otherwise, his absence would have made me love it. But when this was first broadcast, it would be, it's extraordinary, it would be another 7.5 years before Diddly Dum started. So I didn't have that many Doctor Who friends, well, I say friends, to talk to about it. And I used to be mainly confined to things like Outpost Gallifrey. And the big reaction seemed to be on first broadcast that it's sneering at Doctor Who fans. And I don't know how that prevalent that opinion still is, but it isn't at all, is it?
Well, it's sneering at one fan.
I think it's maybe sneering at some Doctor Who fans.
I don't know, but in those first two seasons, from Clive to Elton to Ursula, Bridget, Bliss and Mr. Skinner, they're all actually perfectly normal people.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not geeky at all, are they? Yes, they're people who are to some extent lonely.
Yeah.
But how many of us can say that's not us in an age where most of us don't know most of the people living in our street?
No, no, but I also think, you know, Russell is one of us. And,
yeah,
you know, he had a Dalek whenever he was on the pull and whenever he brought a bloke home.
Yeah.
You know, he'd have to rush in, go, I'm just going to tidy the flat and push a Dalek into the cupboard so that they wouldn't think he was a freak. And, you know, he is a genuine Doctor Who fan who knows why we're into this thing, or suspects why we're into this thing, why it's not football.
Clive has a perfectly normal family with an eminently sensible wife.
Yeah.
If you see about the Doctor, she's a she and an eminently sensible son. So you're not his dad. They're just all people whose lives have been impacted by the Doctor in some way. They're all nice fan portrayals. It is WizKid in Greatest Show who's the patronising...
Yeah.
Look down on Doctor Who fans, isn't it?
When I interviewed Stephen Wyatt for my podcast, we talked about WizKid, and he was like, well, yeah, he was obviously supposed to be based on annoying fans I had met. And then they went full on and cast Adrian Mole to play him. So, you know, that's probably the sneeriest at a time when the show was dying as well, and they decided to pop at their fans. But in this, I think what it is, it's a certain class of fan, and they gather around a man who, you know, Victor Kennedy is based upon, who, I mean, we could probably say his name, can't we? Ian Levine. So there is a certain type of fan. I'm not tiptoeing around Ian Levine because I've been on his bloody Facebook group and it's fucking toxic and horrible and I couldn't follow it anymore. And that sort of entitled Doctor Who fan who doesn't, you know, really doesn't know how to not sweat the small stuff. Doesn't know how to go, it's just a TV show that we all love, but it's just a TV show. Isn't able to separate, gets too intense. But, it, you know, there's no love lost between Levine and Russell. There's that brilliant quote from, you know, when Ian Levine was trying to sort of ask questions and Russell T. Davies said, look, I'm sorry, Ian, you're not a journalist, f*** off. So I think that's the only sneer, is at the arsehole fans, the people that really get really angry all the fucking time about everything.
And, yeah, the people who possess the rare stuff as well and are, like, gatekeepery about it. Well, certainly who were back in, like, the 90s and things like that, who, like, had rare footage and had, yeah, I've got some stuff, but if you have to be in my special clique to see it. And it's very much like the moment where he sits down here with his laptop, isn't it? And he's going, oh, come around. Look, you see the Doctor there? Oh, this bit's missing the picture, but I've still got the audio. And that is just a classic... episodes Doctor Who stuff, isn't it? I think what's particularly actually quite mean about the portrayal of Ian Levine, really, is if you consider that they chose the Absorbaloff to be the analogue, if you like, of Ian Levine, the and like this disgusting, repulsive blob. If you know that that's supposed to be Ian Levine, I think that's quite insulting, isn't it?
It is, although it could have been worse, because as they say in the Red Button thing, when the kid who invented it comes on set and then he looks like he's sulking and not very happy, And they go, here's the Absorbaloff. You invented the Absorbaloff. You won the Blue Peter competition. And apparently he doesn't look very happy. And then they go, what's wrong? And he goes, it was supposed to be as big as a double-decker bus.
I think, though, when fans were outraged, they weren't being outraged at what Victor Kennedy was supposed to be. They were outraged at what the members of Linda were supposed to be. Because I don't think they would have minded if they'd realised that RTD was portraying an element of fandom in a monster. But the fact that, oh, here are these just ordinary people.
Yeah, I mean, also, what do people think they are? I recognise myself in Elton, you know.
What, the dancing?
Yeah. No, but, you know, in Elton Pope, I recognise myself in those people.
Yeah.
But I'm probably more like Ursula. But, you know, like the fact that we are normal-ish people, but there is Doctor Who being, you know, the whole nerd thing, is a certain type of person.
Yeah. In DWM 371, they had a set visit when they were filming it. And whoever it was speaking to Russell. And he says, I think people presume that it's a satire when something is merely referenced. He says, it does dramatise aspects of fandom with a few jokes, but that doesn't make it a satire. A satire would be much more vicious. Linda sitting around for 3 years analysing the doctor's toenail, only to discover they've got the wrong doctor, that sort of thing. Satire's quite easy. Students do satire. I had something else to say. This is honestly about fandom in general. Everyone's a fan of something, and it's a tribute to it. The point about Linda is that they forget the doctor after a while and make friends. They're genuinely good mates. That's what good fandom does. It's real passion and connection and fun. And that's not said often enough. Poor Victor is more of a super fan, only interested in the Doctor at the exclusion of all else. As a result, he spoils it for everyone else. Now, interestingly, in all the future interviews Russell does about Love and Monsters, he denies vociferously that Victor Kennedy is meant to be an analogue of a super fan. But that's what I like. When they actually... Oh, it's a bit silly when they form a band.
Oh, the miming's terrible, though. They can't play their instruments at all. It's awful.
That's half the fun of it, though, isn't it?
But getting together, you know, after a while, Bridget started bringing food. And then, was it Bridget and Mr... What's his name?
Skinner.
And Mr. Skinner, who end up kissing goodbye just before she's...
Yeah.
Killer. I think that's lovely, that.
Mm.
And you do care that they're gone. You know this whole thing that they say about Robert Holmes is, oh, he does effortless world-building. And the other thing they say about RTD is he affects characterisation in just a few sentences.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're the guy who studies this sort of thing for a living here. What does he actually do? Because everyone said to me, what does he actually do to effect this almost instant characterisation of a brand-new character? I have no idea. You have any idea what he does?
Oof, I'd have to watch it again. I mean, there are just... When you're studying a script with analysing it in mind, then you do go, oh, he did this, he did that. But the art of it is you don't notice until you intentionally go and have a look. If I rack my brains to think... But there is just something about that group of characters. You instantly know who they are, don't you?
I think one line... Although it's from a character that we already know, which is Jackie Tyler. But I think there's one very brief exchange which kind of says so much about her and that brief relationship that she has with Elton. And that's the bit when they're having the wine. And he says...
Cheers.
Cheers.
Very nice. What's that, French?
I suppose so. They know how to do things. The French...
I suppose so. Do you know what I mean? It's so much Jackie Tyler, just those three words.
Well, Jackie, the latest, well, you know, one of the long line of Russell T. Davis women that he always does so well, you know, from Queer as Folk, the sort of mums of the boys in Queer as Folk, and there's always, he knows his parent age.
Yeah. She's very Hazel, isn't she?
Yeah. But I love the fact that some of these ideas, I mean, this is another thing that writers do, is in that thing Russell was saying, he's sort of had this idea as a comic strip of someone who basically, I mean, he doesn't say this, but a bit like the Woody Allen the Woody Allen film Zelig or Forrest Gump or something, somebody who's there for every historical event, but this person there for all manner of Doctor Who related, you know, you'd see the Loch Ness Monster in the Thames in the 70s and on, and, you know, probably see a weird dinosaur fight in central London, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, having that idea. But then when he was first in TV producing Why Don't You?
Yeah, yeah, do you remember that? Why don't you switch off the television set?
And go do something less boring instead.
Yeah, yeah. But I used to watch that and be fascinated because the accents were always really weird compared to what I was used to. When they're like Geordies and from Belfast and things. But anyway, but yeah, the fact that Linda comes from a script in Why Don't You?
Really?
A Liverpool investigation something. And that's, so he reused that idea. But it's just, that's another thing that writers have in common is you just have, years ago I had, you know, Jimmy McGovern who, you know, like Cooper and all sorts. We had a sort of seminar with him and he gave us all a photocopied document of lots and lots of things he'd typed through his years. And we got to take it home. But during the seminar, I was just going, if you look at this, that idea then, wrote that in 1977, became the film Priest. That eventually became a plot in something else. And everything he's sort of written all through his life in various different years all got, you know, you throw shit at the wall and it doesn't stick, but you pick the shit up again and then you throw the same at the wall and it sticks this time. So that's a very common thing is you're constantly making stories up in your head and you never quite know when they're going to stick. And it's just really good with Russell. You know, he is like the ultimate TV writer, I think, you know, British TV writer. So it's just all those different ideas that he has and you never quite know which one's going to get suddenly get into the script.
It's interesting, this idea for originally a DWM comic strip about this boy who grows up seeing all the various Doctor Who monsters in London throughout the 60s and the 70s, like the Skerrison. Because when Russell novelises Rose, he dates Clive's link to the Doctor as being that Clive's father was killed in the Shoreditch incident, which is Remembrance of the Daleks.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I thought was interesting. So clearly that's something that's been... I'm not sure when he novelised Rose. Was it been before he wrote this?
No, it's after.
It would have been long after, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's a long time off.
I think that's part of a fan brain as well, especially if you're a writer anyway, and I think that's why Big Finish sort of taps into that. It's and again with Cutaway, it's that what if, you know, this happened, so therefore, and it's just kind of fun, you know, without going into the toxic fan thing of shouting about plots and headcanons and whether something's canon or not. But it's just really interesting to go, well, obviously, this alien attack has happened the year before and this alien attack happened then, and it's, you know, you sort of hold all these different stories together and if you go, well, you know, what about the bystanders? What about the people that we saw in the background? And that's where this Love and Monsters comes from, isn't it? It's about the people that, you know, in that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern kind of way, the people that aren't in the main action.
Mm.
Which I guess is the first Double Bank episode. It kind of makes sense that was the angle he decided to go on. While the main cast is away, what are these bunch of people doing that we haven't met before and we're only going to meet for this week? And then Moffat does the same with Sally Sparrow and Angels the next season. So it's a really nice little... Like Russell says in the Red Button thing, he didn't invent it. It's something that genre stuff does quite a lot every so often. It's just really nice to go, here's a one-off story in this universe.
It's a little sidestep on the main thing. And also, I think it's placed perfectly in Series 2 as well, just after the impossible planet Satan Pit, which is really heavy and dark.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we get this. Then you've got Fear Her, but then we're coming into the, as foreshadowed by Elton saying, I keep thinking of Rose and Jackie and how long before they pay the price for meeting the Doctor. And so that's just a couple of episodes before we get to Doomsday, which is, as far as Series 2 is concerned, is the end of a story for Rose and Jackie at the time. And it's a lovely little kind of palate cleanser.
Yeah.
Just before we get to that big finale.
Yeah, well, I think it's another thing Russell knows so well as well is, you know, he knows how to stick the tracks on an album, so to speak. he knows what it's like to watch a season.
Yes.
And that was one of the things they always say. I think your interview with Rob Sherman, Rob sort of repeated what he says, but, you know, you can't take that much credit for Dalek, because obviously you can take some, but it was Russell knowing that was the way to do it and where he placed in the season. You know, the way Russell brought Doctor Who back was kind of genius. Because I still relive it all the time. I still remember going, that first episode had moments. I'm not completely convinced. Oh, I really didn't like End of the World. Although there were some really moving moments, and they suddenly start talking about my mum's been dead 5 billion years. And that made me sit up in my seat. And then the Slovene was a bit silly, but it was all right. And then they just hit us with Dalek. And then we've just never looked back. And it's, you know, just genius. It was like, get the kids in, get the families in, then here's our version of Genesis of the Daleks, where it's all going to go really, really hardcore. And just keep dipping in and out of that. We'll have a Love of Monsters, and then we'll have a Fear Here. And, you know, we had Satan before, and after that, we're going to have absolute heart-wrenching. Like, at the time, people really cried. I cried at the end of Doomsday.
Oh, well, I recently rewatched Doomsday. Well, I say recently, it was a couple of years ago now. Rewatched Doomsday with my friend's young daughters. And I can't remember how old the youngest one was. She was about 7 or something. And a couple of days later, it was Army of Ghosts, and Doomsday was being re-shown. It came up on the iPlayer again. And she was like, oh, can I watch that again? Because she remembered really enjoying the Daleks and the Cybermen. And then it got to the bit where the Doctor and Rose were either side of that wall. And she was sat there in absolute floods of tears. And she turned around to her mum and said, Mum, why did you let me watch this again?
That's the part. She'll never forget that feeling. Like, in a good way, I mean. That's pure power of drama, that is.
Yeah.
That's joyous. I just love stuff like that. And that whole era worked so well. And then he sort of topped it with, you know, with the Donna stuff. And and it's going to be really interesting to see what. If it was anybody else, I'd think, be careful returning to something. But because it's Russell T. Davies, you just know it's going to be brilliant. It's going to be even better because he's had 15 years of honing his craft. Which was pretty good.
Yeah, I agree. I think even his running of the whole production side of things and into the promotion side of things is just so much better again. It's like a real expert suddenly in charge.
I was actually thinking that when we were thinking, what Doctor Who news is to be, and there's not been that much. But there was the new Sonic Screwdriver.
Yeah.
And I just went, God. It's just a little thing, but having a nice video of the new Sonic Screwdriver, as Chibnall didn't let us know anything was happening, ever. He just went, it's going to be on when it's on. Russell T. Davies is a showman. He knows what business he's in. He's in show business. He's not in, write a script and stick it in a drawer and hope someone opens the drawer.
He's not sitting Stephen Fry and Lenny Henry in front of a tatty old curtain and suddenly switching a light on and going, look. It's Stephen Fry. And you can even hear the click of the light switch as the light comes on. And there's that tatty old curtain behind them. And it's like, oh, my God. So what is this promotion?
Yeah, or giving John Bishop so little to do that he does that. Did you see that, really? I think it was on BBC Breakfast when he's just going, so what can you tell us about you? Your new character? He's a plasterer. And he's like, that's pretty much all he could say.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a plasterer. It's just, but yeah, the new golden age.
Yes, let's hope so. It feels good at the moment, doesn't it, sir?
I mean, I've never quite understood why people are so annoyed by David Tennant, to be honest. You seem to be quite an anti-Tennant podcast with Hayden and you, Doc. Would that be fair to say?
We never know what Mark thinks about Tennant because he never gets a word in edgeways when Hayden and I start on it. I don't think we ever get over that sort of smugness of that relationship with him and Rose. Martha effectively is a cipher, isn't she?
Yeah.
And then, I've never liked Donna much. And I think there's an element in there of...
So I totally disagree with you about Donna.
I think Donna's brilliant.
I mean, I saw Tennant and Donna once on... what's the show that...
Never mind the Buzzcocks.
and around the Buzzcocks during this period, and they were so insufferably delighted with each other. Tash wanted to reach in through the screen and punch them.
They are mates, though, so, you know.
I mean, this is almost the point at which this story is spoilt for me, when he returns at the end.
Well, yeah. No, I don't know. There's no getting away from the fact that I'm absolutely fine with David Tennant being the Doctor. It was a glorious time. Now I've gone back, I can maybe see that he's a little bit, like, calm down a bit. A little bit much. And the one thing that's changed in my head is I didn't miss Christopher Eccleston at the time when he became David Tennant. I just went along with it. And now I really wish we'd had more Christopher Eccleston.
Yeah.
Because I think he was aware that he did those awful things. Like whenever he smiles or tried to be a bit funny.
He gurns a bit, yeah.
Yeah, that makes me die a bit inside. I remember reading an interview, he was aware of that, or I could never quite do that stuff properly. And if he'd just basically been a grumpy, serious doctor for his second season, I think we'd have had it would have just been amazing. But I'm loving his big finish stuff. That's a pretty good substitute.
I also wonder whether... I don't particularly think that... Yeah, obviously everything's relative. Better than me, for instance. But I don't particularly think that David Tennant... I don't think he's a particularly good actor.
Really?
I mean, when you see some of the stuff that Eccleston does, and when you see on the other side some of the stuff that Smith is doing in that first series, I don't think... See, I've not seen him in much else. I think I vaguely remember seeing him in Casanova, but... No.
No, he is, I don't know. There's no getting away from the fact he's a very good actor, I would say. It might just be he's not to your taste. He's very up, I guess, is the thing. But it's weird, like now, for years I would have said David Tennant was my favourite of the new Doctors, and now I'd probably say Eccleston. And if Capaldi had had better stories, probably Capaldi, because I think he was phenomenal.
I tell you, I think he's a better actor. I thought Mark Warren was brilliant in this.
Yes, he's really good, yeah.
Amazing actor, yeah.
I think all the cast is pretty good in this. But yeah. Mark Warren's, yeah, very... Because you've got to be... I was thinking that as well. I think you've got to be quite some actor to carry this episode in the way that is required of the lead actor here. Because that's a lot of work.
Yeah. He's not been the lead in enough things. It's surprising. Yeah. He was like that Mr. Norrell, but that kind of came and went, didn't it?
Very, very famously in State of Play, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
I remember thinking back at the time when they were saying, and Peter Kay's going to be in Doctor Who. I remember my heart sinking and thinking, oh, God, he's not, is he? Not that I've got a thing against Peter Kay, but when they said, oh, and in sort of, you know, almost in the, as an aside, oh, and someone called Mark Warren has been casting Doctor Who, that sort of thing would excite me.
I could see him as a Doctor.
Oh, yes, so could I.
I mean, he's 56 now. Can you believe it?
I think you'll find that all the very best men are 56 this year, Ian. And anyone who likes Mr. Blue Sky has got to be...
Can I just say as well, that's lovely use of towards the end of the episode when they've got that final sort of little montage and they play the end of Mr. Blue Sky over it, right up to the electronic voice saying, please turn me over. It's lovely.
Is it really... If there's any haters out there who haven't watched Love and Monsters for a long time, please, please go and give it another go.
Yes.
Didn't they say something like that was because Mr. Blue Sky came at the end of side three of the double album or something?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
Right, shall we give it a score out of 10?
Ooh.
I would give it a... I'd give it a 7.5. Ian?
I've just written down a solid 7. But I often think, because I used to review movies and things for a living, that I'm sometimes a bit harsher on these things because I was conscious. You can't just go 4 and 5 stars all the bloody time.
No, I know what you mean.
It gets really boring. But the fact is, 7's really good.
Yeah.
7's like... You know, it's a 7, I guess 7, 7.5, but it's still not up there with the absolute best of the best.
No.
You know, it's brilliant, but it's in the middle, and it's not by any means. So, yeah, 7 is actually fair when you think, what have you got to do for me to become a 10?
Yeah, I think you can have really enjoyable sixes and sevens sometimes that you can be very fond of and you know, get a lot of pleasure from. And just because they're not an 8, 9 or 10 doesn't mean that they're, you know, somehow lacking.
I don't think there's many I would give a 10 to. Maybe Human Nature, Family of Blood. That's so well done. And then every, for me, there's not a, a single thing wrong with it.
I would give this, I hate to do it, but as soon as, before Doc had said 7.5, I was thinking, oh, I think probably about 7.5. So that was my instinct. So I'm going to go with it.
It was a sort of casual miracle, considering what the starting point was, a shit monster.
Yes, yeah.
Tee Kid had invented. And I'm still not a massive fan of Peter Kay being in it. I don't mind him, but he's not a bonus for me. He's not a plus point for me.
No.
Although he does say eczema in a very good way.
Right. Mark, you're going out shopping later, aren't you? You've got your shopping list. Can you add a new profanity bleeper, please? I think ours is going to be worn out. Here come the Sons of Skara to say goodbye to us. Daleks Garros, do you have any advice from us on blocked toilet systems?
Emergency regulations. Please do not dump babies into the river.
Dalek Ray, we have film critics in the museum.
It's a trap!
Thanks for joining us, Ian.
Yeah, that was a really interesting chat, Ian. Thank you.
Hey, Ian, I loved it.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Yeah. Bye!
Hang on a minute, we've talked about credible plotting, haven't we? So, Ian, you're actually a highly sophisticated writer.
That's right.
Not a plumber.
No.
So, when you were mending our upstairs toilet earlier, you had no qualifications whatsoever. Hang on, what's this coming downstairs? It's a flood of water!
Oops.
No!
Oh!
Oh no! It's filling the whole room!
Oh!
Ian, quick! Take Mark! He'll be all right with you behind the mirrors! Oh!
Good
boy! Oh, my eye, listeners! Been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at Diddly Dum, on iTunes at Diddly Dum Podcast, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. The empty space that circles time.